Do you know your net worth? Or can you even list all your financial accounts? Believe it or not, most people can't. The problem is simple. When you don't track your finances, you leave hard-earned money on the table by overspending and undersaving. Monarch is the solution, an all-in-one personal finance tool that brings your entire financial life together in one clean interface on your laptop or phone. In just minutes, you can link all your accounts to see a clear, complete picture of your financial health. With data visualizations and AI-driven insights, Monarch helps you spot patterns, cut wasteful spending, and make better financial decisions without ever touching a spreadsheet. Monarch more than pays for itself. In fact, users save over $200 a month on average. That's why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch the best budgeting app of 2025. Get 50% off your first year. That's just $50 total when you use code BALANCE at monarch.com. That's monarch.com, promo code BALANCE. Monarch, the modern way to manage money.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is Boontle Sene, a transformation expert, and Sarah Louise Ackrell, a therapist and entrepreneur. Together, they have written The ND Lovers Club, How Neurodivergent Women Lust, Like, and Love. It's an unapologetically feminist manifesto meet self-help book that rewrites the rules on love, lust, and relationships for neurodivergent women. And it's nothing like what you've been told. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Hi.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us. So, Boontle, let's start with you. Just for anybody who doesn't know, explain what ND or neurodivergent means.
So people might have heard a couple of terms for this, ND, neurodivergent, neurodiverse. All it means is people whose brains work differently. And so it's an umbrella term that encompasses people who have ADHD, people who are autistic, people who are dyslexic, people who have Tourette's syndrome, and there's many other sensory learning complications that arise under that umbrella.
Yeah. And how easy or difficult can it be to be diagnosed for these various different conditions? I guess a lot of people maybe go through life not realizing that they have one of these things.
It can be really challenging if you are in any kind of minority group because you're less likely to have a positive health outcome. So even if you are in our cultural context here in the UK, white or middle class or whatever, you're still going to find it hard. It can take 3 to 10 years on the NHS waiting list. You can pay £2,000 per diagnosis and you'll never have just traits of one. You'll have several. So that can be multiples of £2,000 a time, which is clearly very expensive. So yeah, there's lots of barriers to getting diagnosed.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it must be difficult for people to identify sometimes or realize that they are different, if you like, because we're all different, aren't we? I mean, we all have different personalities. We all have different ways of dealing with things and situations. So are there any kind of tips to understanding without having to pay for that diagnosis that you do have one of these conditions, maybe?
I think we are really lucky to live in a time of the internet and social media because there is a lot of information. And how I got diagnosed in my 30s, I had no idea that I was both autistic and ADHD. And I only discovered this because social media kept on showing me this content from women who were talking about, you know, being daydreaming, being impulsive, having too much energy, having too little energy. All of these things were traits that I saw. And so I think people will find clues in their own behavior and history, and social media and the internet now has a lot of people talking about these topics to help you on your journey of understanding.
Yeah.
Go on. I was going to say that neurodivergent people, they have an intact brain structure, just like neurotypical people, but their brain activity is markedly different. So although we are all different, we are either neurodivergent or neurotypical, and there is quite a significant difference in brain activity.
Ah, okay. And I guess, I mean, is that something that would be difficult to self-diagnose, to understand what your brain activity is like and whether you're neurotypical or neurodiverse?
I think absolutely. But this is also why we don't use scans of the brain to come up with some of these diagnoses. people are best able to self-report and be the experts on their own situations. And so I think no one should doubt the fact that they're experiencing these traits. They're not a personality thing. They're not a choice. It's not a mental health challenge. But when you start to see these traits, a pattern does form. And so that's also how indie women tend to find each other and how Sarah and I found each other, just weird girls who didn't have other friends. Who had a choice, shared experience.
And our
challenges are often social and communication wise, so it's not really in the medical realm as such. It's a lot to do with difference and social and communication difference.
Right. And do you think these types of issues are a lot more prevalent now than they were 10, 20 years ago? Or is it just that we understand the differences more now? Because, you know, the 10 years ago, as I say, people weren't talking about these kind of things so much. So is it that people just weren't aware of it then?
Yeah, I think it definitely was. You can think of it like people who are left-handed and right-handed. For a very long time, hundreds of years, people who were left-handed were presumed to be in a very small minority. It was only when schools started allowing children to write with both left and right hands that we figured out that there's actually quite a substantial amount of the population that is left-handed. And I think the same goes with neurodiversity. For people who are ADHD, we used to think that was just a boy being hyperactive, running around at school. And now we have all sorts of different traits and representations, like the girl who's daydreaming, staring out the window, to recognize and look for.
Yeah. And presumably, as you said at the beginning, you know, it's a big umbrella term. And when we talk about children, particularly suffering with ADHD and various other conditions, there's a lot of talk of medication, I guess, for adults as well. And it must be very difficult for parents to understand and to have those conversations with doctors as to whether their child or even yourself as an adult should or need medication, or whether it's something that you or the child can cope with and deal with without the medication.
Yeah, with medication, I think it's really difficult because people already carry this, am I broken? You know, I don't want my child to rely on meds, or I don't want them to have a dependency. I want them to be more resilient, etc. I would say just have a really good discussion with a doctor. Be as open-minded as possible. Look to see if there's alternatives. Can you help them with some coaching, with some communication skills? But I think when you've looked at the other options, when the child reaches a certain age, it's responsible to at least consider meds, because if they're going through uni, for example, we do have, unfortunately, a very high suicide rate in our community. And I do speak to young people and their parents an awful lot. And if the challenges are just unbearable and they can't physically perform, I think it's even worse for their mental health at the end of the day, not to give them the chance to explore that. But it is a very sensitive topic, of course.
Yeah. So why is it that you decided to write this book looking specifically at the subject of love and sex and relationships?
I think that Sarah's described this before as an area that caused her the most emotional pain in her day-to-day life, and I can certainly relate to that. It is something where everybody wants to be loved, everybody wants to find their person or their people, and that becomes a lot more difficult if you can't figure out the social cues of dating, if every time you try to date someone you become obsessed or in love with them, if you are experiencing things like rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is a perceived overreaction to rejection, whether it's actually happened or not. All of those things make you seem like quite a strange person to be in a relationship with if you have no context for that and you have no way to explain to someone this is what's going on with you.
Yeah. You don't have to go into details if you don't want to, Sarah, but have you had difficulties then in this area because of your, I don't want to say condition. How do I summarize it? Condition sounds a bit extreme.
My difference?
Your difference. There we go.
Let's go with that. Yes, I would definitely say I really struggled with limerence, or what we would normally call infatuation. I would make a person my special interest or my obsessive focus without even realizing as a child. It's things like, in the book, we talk about things like anything from, you know, what do you do if your partner or if you are asexual or aromantic? We cover things like you're not broken, the diversity with very gender fluid, with very sexuality fluid. But yes, me personally, my goodness, I'm not going to back out of confessing that it was pretty challenging for a very, very long time. And I'm sure it will be again in the future.
Yeah. And I suppose not just challenging for you, but challenging for the person that you're dating or in a relationship with. This book is also really helpful for people who are living with or in a relationship with someone who's neurodivergent.
Yeah, 100%. We also think that even if you're not in a romantic relationship with someone who's neurodivergent, these traits come up in all sorts of types of relationships. So even if you have a friend or a family member, this is helpful to read. And I think there are already a lot of books that are geared towards neurotypical people and how to deal with, in inverted commas, people who are neurodiverse. This book says you're not a burden. It's not difficult to date you. There isn't a problem with you. You just need to understand how your brain works and be able to communicate to others because they want to understand. But just like you didn't know what was going on your whole life, they don't know either.
Yeah. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I suppose for people who are spending time with people who are neurodivergent, as you say, whether it's a family member, a work colleague, or a sexual relationship, if they don't know that they're neurodivergent, I guess the person who's with them might not know, and the two of them are just going around banging their heads against the wall, having all kinds of troubles without realizing why.
Oh, absolutely. And you can also be in a relationship with a neurodivergent person, of course, but their neurodiversity doesn't show up anything like yours does. You know, you could be an extrovert and neurodivergent or an introvert. You might be a little bit rigid with your routines. You may like touch. You may love touch. You might hate touch. So you can show up very differently. The communication is really important, but that's the one thing we really struggle with. So you can see why this is a very delicate topic.
Yeah. And very, very difficult to understand, as I say, because there could be people that just don't realize, just find someone awkward or difficult to be around. I'm sure everybody's been in that situation with a friend or a family member or a relationship without thinking or realizing that it could be something like this. I mean, I find it interesting how you would begin to kind of approach the subject if you're dating someone and they don't realize or think that they might be neurodivergent. How would you kind of approach the subject with them, suggesting that they could be?
I mean, I think we always advocate people not trying to diagnose others. And so we try to not do that either. But you can start by educating yourself, right? And reading about some of these things. I had a situation with a friend. I did not know that she was neurodivergent. She didn't know she was neurodivergent. She started explaining a situation that had happened between her and someone at her daughter's school, how she was feeling several days later, still very upset about it, very hurt, even though it wasn't a personal issue at all. And so I said to her, well, do you know this thing called rejection sensitivity dysphoria? This is how it plays out. This might be what's happening to you. Here's how to get a little bit more emotionally regulated. Here's what to remember next time. And that was super helpful to her. And she was able then to see when that came up again, but also start to do some more investigation for herself. When I said, this is something that happens to a lot of neurodivergent women, she then went and did the research. So I would say the best thing to do is educate yourself on some of these things. It's like parents who've been dealing with their children who have dyslexia for years and years. You have to observe, you have to educate yourself so that you can help them.
Yeah, that makes sense. And because there are so many different ways that this can kind of portray itself in a person, was it difficult writing this book? Because there isn't like a black and white, hard, fast rule as to this is what's going to happen to you. This is how you need to deal with it. Was it difficult kind of going through all the the different possible ways that you can deal with these kind of issues?
That's such an amazing question. It's almost like you were there in the room with us. There's a lot of different combinations on this padlock, that is for sure. I would say that we tried to be really big picture, but also really get into the detail. We, between us, I think, have had all sorts of experiences of the residual stuff of relationships and neurodiversity. So complex trauma, sensory needs. I think between us, professionally and personally, we had a lot to put in. But we also, fortunately, had this wonderful network around us of people of different ages and their children who would give us feedback. And, you know, I think we just poured in everything that we had ever learned about this topic for years and years and years. And therefore, we did know about quite a lot of the differences and different combinations.
Mm.
And to be fair, I think that, you know, we're talking about it and we almost make it sound like it's the serious, heavy text that's educational. It's actually pretty funny. We're actually very relaxed and kind of informal people. And we wrote this book, even though we both work in neurodiversity, as something which was our personal experiences. So there's a lot of stories about bad dates and poor decisions and things that worked out somehow. It is a really, the thing which I think that we missed out on was reflecting the whole breadth of neurodiversity, right? Because we only have two or three between us. Mm. We're not dyslexic, for example. We don't have Tourette's syndrome. And I hope that this encourages people who are in that part of the umbrella to also write their own story so we understand how this impacts them.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
And do you kind of, do you suggest that once people know that they are neurodiverse in whichever way, should they kind of tell people pretty much straight away? Is it something that you should introduce to the conversation when you're just starting dating, or you meet a new friend, or you go for a new job? How soon should you let people know, as it were?
I'm going for that one then. Well, Buntler really encouraged me, because I was dating while writing the book, actually. And Buntler really encouraged me to be myself. So I would say, if you have to talk about neurodiversity rather than showing up as neurodivergent, you probably don't feel safe enough with that person or safe enough to be yourself. Not necessarily because they're dangerous, but you, for some reason, I mean, it's very risky, right? Being yourself. We all fear rejection. But if you can just be neurodivergent and not have to talk about it, then I think people will get to know you quicker, because just saying I'm neurodivergent, people are kind of like, well, what do I do with that?
Yeah. And I think what I would say to people who are thinking about whether to disclose or not, it's a little like coming out of the closet. There is some risk associated with it. And I think they should really look at their workplace, understand how inclusive it is to all sorts of people, work out where they can trust their manager and HR. There's a lot of ways in which we end up being discriminated against in the workplace. Someone will find out you're ADHD, and suddenly if you're late, it's because you're ADHD. If you put in a late, it's your ADHD. If you weren't paying attention for 5 minutes, it's your ADHD. So in your personal life, it's a lot easier to find people to trust and disclose that to in the workplace. Those are future books that we're writing together on those kind of interactions, because that's a whole different ballgame.
And there are ways that you can indicate you're neurodivergent without saying the word. So I started to do dating profiles that were kind of like, you know, I am sociable, but I do like my own space. And then I'm not going to meet someone who desperately wants to meet someone every single day and move in, you know. So you can put the feelers out for what your needs are and getting them met without having to label it anything if you don't want to. And sometimes it's more powerful.
Do you feel that sometimes it could, you know, the way that you said, Boontley, there about other people using the label of ADHD as an excuse, like your boss saying, oh, you're late, it's because you've got ADHD. Do you think it could sometimes happen the other way around? People who do have neurodivergent issues kind of, I don't want to say using it as an excuse necessarily, but I think you can see sometimes when people are late or have issues, oh, it's my ADHD, you know, using it as a crutch all the time for things, as if that's an excuse for bad behavior, if you like.
Well, I would say two things. One is that we shouldn't misunderstand the difference between an excuse and an explanation.
Yeah.
Because it may be that someone genuinely is struggling because of their ADHD. And that doesn't mean they can sit around and just say, well, that's how my brain works. Sorry. They do actually have to take some actions. And there's lots of lifestyle changes, therapy, coaching, etc., before they even get to medication. And I've had to do all of those things to feel better. So it is, I think, an opportunity to raise that with that person about, that's cool, what are you doing about it? And I think the second thing is, most people who are neurodivergent are ashamed of being neurodivergent. It's not something they want to scream from the rafters. The only people I've seen who want to tell the world they're neurodivergent is jerks who are trying to explain their terrible behavior to other people and saying, oh, it's because I'm autistic, or it's because I have bipolar. And that's just not true. That doesn't make us terrible people. They're just co-opting that and running with it in a way that 20% of the global population is not doing.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also when you said earlier about finding your people and how you found each other through having similar issues with neurodivergent stuff, presumably people can have really healthy and happy relationships, both friendships in the family or sexual relationships, if you're an ND person or an NT person. You know, the two can work very well together, assuming they just kind of understand each other's differences.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. It's not a reason to be isolated. It is hard to find your tribe. I mean, the businesses that I've built have been, I guess, my way of building, very elaborate way of building a tribe. So I, you know, have friends, but but not, you know, not everyone wants to start a business so they've got neurodivergent people around them. But I think that with the online world, I think that with people being a bit more open, I think there are some lovely resources. I think there are, I mean, if 20% of us are neurodivergent and people in other minority groups, whether they're neurodivergent or not, they all have something in common in that there is such a thing as a minority experience. And there are, we do have certain things in common, which I think by having friends that are more diverse generally, not just neurodivergent, I have felt a sense of belonging and meaning and empowerment and community that I've not had before. But I would say that's in the last sort of 5 or so years that I've really come into my own, like a lot of late diagnosed perimenopausal women.
Yeah. Oh, it's just great. I think it's amazing that it's being talked about more so people can understand the different issues, either that they're going through themselves or that their loved ones are experiencing. And then, well, the world will just be a happier place, won't it?
Absolutely. Here.
Well, it's been great to have you both on the show, Boontley Sene and Sarah Louise Ackrell. Thank you both very much for joining us. And when you've got your next book out, let me know.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
No worries. If people want to get a copy of the ND Lovers Club, How Neurodivergent Women Lust, Like and Love, it's available on our website, tre.radio. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you. Bye-bye.